The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
State Senator Tracy McCreary just wrapped up her first year in the Missouri Senate. But the St. Louis County Democrat is hardly a neophyte to the chamber, as she served as a staffer in the 2000s to then-Senator Joan Bray. McCreary joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about her impressions of the Senate and some of the issues that she worked on over the past few months. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio and not via Zoom, she covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us for the first time as the senator for the 24th District, we have in studio today,
State Senator Tracy McCreary.
Now, before we talk about your first year in the Senate, the 24th District has changed dramatically since redistricting. It used to go east-west in St. Louis County, and now it appears to be going north-south. Can you just talk about the boundaries of your district?
Great question. Yeah, so for decades now, the old Senate District 24 ran east-west down Olive Boulevard, basically. Because the Volunteer Commission doing redistricting couldn't agree on a map, the judges took the Senate District 24, and it now runs north-south. It runs up and down Interstate 270 in St. Louis County from the St. Charles County line all the way down to the Jefferson County line.
You started your career as a staffer for Senator Joan Bray, who represented the 24th District when it was more east-west. And now you're serving in that same seat. I'm curious, what is the difference thus far in being the senator as opposed to working for the senator?
Well, it's an amazing experience. And, you know, I'm so thankful that I had that experience basically doing constituent services for a state senator, because I think that makes me more in touch with constituents when they do reach out with challenges and problems that they're having. But it's definitely a huge honor to be on the other side now in the Missouri State Senate.
When I was interviewing Republican Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman at the end of session, she mentioned that the freshman class, which is the people that were elected in 2022, was especially close. Now, it should be noted that most of the new senators are Republicans.
Yeah, I was the only Democrat.
Were you able to join on these hangouts?
Of course. Or
were you snubbed because of your party?
No. I was embraced with open arms. You know, the interesting thing about the state Senate is there aren't really Republicans or Democrats over there. There are just 34 state senators, and things really felt a lot different just from switching over from the House to the Senate.
One of the ongoing storylines that have defined Missouri politics over the past few years is friction between the House and the Senate. We kind of saw that during veto session when the Senate declined to override any budgetary vetoes. Why do you think this, you know, friction endures?
Well, some of this is by design. You know, the process is supposed to be slow and deliberative, and the two chambers have different styles of analyzing proposals. So, you know, I was really disappointed, though, that none of the Republican senators took an opportunity to show their support for law enforcement, for example. There were several things that the House overrode in the governor's budget that I think the Senate should have at least had a debate on.
What that include, like, the call center?
It includes a call center for 911, but it also includes pay raises for some of our law enforcement officers as well. And, you know, for a party that claims to support law enforcement, they certainly didn't show that on veto session day.
Do you expect that the legislature will be able to actually accomplish anything next year when there are high-profile elections going on?
Well, it seems like we're in a perpetual election cycle, quite honestly. Because of term limits, people are constantly running for higher office. So I don't think 2024 is going to feel much different. You know, there are going to be some interesting dynamics, though, in the Senate chamber. There are some folks running against each other, for example.
There's also going to be a high-profile Republican primary for governor. And this may be an inside baseball question, but I think it's actually a question about how the Senate will operate. Could you see some senators essentially work as proxies for either Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe, Senator Bill Igel, Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, and that kind of dominates the one-upsmanship kind of dominates the Senate next year?
Well, to be honest with you, I already saw it happen this year in 2023. And this Republican primary for governor seems like it's been going on now, you know, since Parson got, you know, elected a few years ago. So, you know, I just think that what we saw in the state Senate with all these folks clamoring to win the Republican nomination for governor is they're just pushing these extreme Republican views and policies, and they're just pushing each other so far to the right that I think it's going to make it really challenging for whoever wins the nomination to win the general election.
To reflect on this session a little bit, you were a key senator who pushed for the Medicaid to be expanded for postpartum mothers. It finally made it past the finish line with a little bit of drama. How do you think this, you know, why do you think this was the first year this policy made it through the Senate?
Well, for one thing, there was a senator who was termed out who blocked that, even though that senator was a physician. You would think that a physician would support keeping new moms alive, but he did not. So the most, you know, this maternal mortality bill that we passed, Senate Bills 45 and 90, is about keeping new moms alive. So we have a mortality review board that looks at all of the deaths of pregnant women and new moms in the state. The most recent data I have says that every year, 70 Missouri women die while pregnant or within 1 year of pregnancy. And that's a lot. 70 women die every year while pregnant or within 1 year of pregnancy. But the thing that made me and my colleagues lose sleep at night was 84% of those deaths would be preventable if the woman had access to health care. So that means every year, 59 Missouri women would still be alive if we could just give them health care. And, you know, that's why it got done this year.
You know, I wrote about this, you know, quite a bit after it was passed. But how do you think this will help reduce the state's maternal mortality rate, which has been high for quite a long time?
Well, Todd Richardson and his team at Missouri HealthNet are already implementing this law, even though technically it's not been approved by the federal government. We're already saving lives right now. The bill that passed had an emergency clause, and I'm really proud of the department for going ahead and making sure that these new moms have a full year of health care after they give birth.
Yeah, and Medicaid is a massive program, and oftentimes we hear stories from news outlets and otherwise about its ability to bring people into the system or retain people into the system, which we'll talk about in a minute, is just very, very challenging. How confident are you that the moms that are eligible for this will actually be able to successfully sign up and get the benefits?
Well, I believe the department, and I take the department at their word, they are already implementing this program, and I believe that as new moms are hitting the end of that 60 days of insurance post delivery, that they are automatically being enrolled so that they have health care for a full year after having a baby.
The Missouri Independent reported earlier this week that of the 12,833 people taken off of Medicaid last month, most lost coverage because of paperwork issues, not eligibility issues. This seems to happen periodically with this program. Is it because of short staffing or computer issues or something else? What's your thought on that?
I think it's a little bit of everything, but I also feel like when you look at the number of children that are being kicked off the program, you know, my frustration is I think there are a lot of adults, guardians, parents that don't realize the importance of getting this paperwork back into the state of Missouri. And, you know, this is an example of kids being punished for something that their parents or guardians did not do. So, you know, I've been in close contact with Missouri Health Net, just urging them to do everything they can to take an all hands on deck approach to making sure that we're not losing kids in this process.
One thing that did not pass last session were efforts to expand state support for child care services. Why do you think that issue couldn't get past the finish line?
Well, there were a handful of extremists that just did not want to see us do anything with that, which is so frustrating because pretty much everybody you talk to is talking about the child care crisis in one form or another. You know, you talk to the Chamber of Commerce members, but even just small businesses, in order to fill job openings that folks have all around the state in towns big and small, we need to figure out a way to get those that have kids back to work. And we can't expect parents to just, you know, settle for less. We want kids to have access to high quality, safe, educational, and affordable childcare. And that's something I think that should be the number one thing we focus on next session.
Are you anticipating seeing that really be
a focus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely do.
What do you think the state government could do to meaningfully help expand access to childcare? Wouldn't this be something that the federal government would have more of an impact on, especially since they would have more money to help subsidize or defray costs for both businesses or people seeking childcare?
Well, some of that federal money that helped during the pandemic that helped with childcare has gone away. So that is now as the state of Missouri, we have to realize that nobody's going to come and save us. We have to do this ourselves. We have to take responsibility for this. And I worked closely with the other 11 female state senators to brainstorm creative ideas that could help address this child care shortage.
Is some of the creative ideas revolving around tax credits? And if so, how would that functionally work from what you've seen so far?
Well, one of the things I was intrigued by is this idea that we could have an area that could, where several businesses, they're not big enough to have their own on-site daycare, but they, you know, I envision like a business park where there's several medium-sized businesses. They could say, hey, let's come together and create a child care center out here in this area, and then we as a state help encourage that and support that. I think that's a great example of thinking outside of the box.
And that actually happens with the daycare where my children have gone. It's really close to the Wells Fargo building on Market Street. And the vast majority of parents that send their kids to that childcare are from Wells Fargo. So that is like an example of that
right. Being
able to work.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, people get frustrated with state government that we're too rigid, that we just want to throw money at problems. I think we need to have a climate in the legislature where we're allowed to think outside of the box and be creative.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Senator Tracy McCreary. And we're back on Politically Speaking with Senator Tracy McCreary. She is a Democrat from St. Louis County. Okay, so one of the bills that I saw that you sponsored this year that caught my attention was requiring animal control officers to become mandated reporters if they see child abuse or neglect. Can you talk about this bill and what was kind of the genesis behind it?
Sure. This is a bill that a lot of us call the cross-reporting bill. And it's basically this idea that there are vulnerable Missourians among us, and those include kids, senior citizens, and those with different abilities. And what we are trying to do is make sure that if someone's eyes notice something that might be suspicious and hits some key indicators that there might be potential child abuse, that would get reported and investigated. And, you know, there is a lot of data out there that shows that animal abuse is linked to relationship violence and child abuse. So I think this is a no-brainer. If we have animal control officers and investigators going out to investigate potential animal abuse, if they see something that doesn't look right, now, of course, they would be highly trained. If they see something that looks suspicious that meets the criteria for reporting it, I want those folks to be empowered to do that because I truly believe it could save some children's lives.
This bill would also require reporting of what's known as companion animal abuse. Can you just explain what that is and how it would kind of go hand in hand with this bill?
Right. So I used to be on the board of Safe Connections, which is St. Louis's oldest and largest agency that works to help survivors of sexual assault and relationship violence. I am very aware of the role that animals play in a family's decision to flee an abusive home. So what happens sometimes in houses, is that an abuser will harm the companion animal, which is just really a pet. But it doesn't have to just be a cat or a dog. The abuser abuses the animal or threatens to abuse the animal in order to control the other family members. And so, you know, it's just very, very important that we are educated on the data. This isn't just me speculating. There is hard research, hard data out there that says that, you know, that there's a correlation between animal abuse and abuse of people.
So the reason this caught my attention is that I have been looking into issues that have arisen over the past few years in the children's division, especially in the St. Louis area, in St. Louis and St. Louis County. And it's not really a secret that the Department of Social Services and the children's division is having trouble with a pretty large backlog of abuse and neglect cases. And part of the problem is that the office in St. Louis is really struggling to hire investigators. Here is Department of Social Services Director Robert Nerdell talking about this issue.
And the difficulty that we've had staffing in the St. Louis region for some time, it was made, it was exacerbated by the pandemic and simply an unprecedented competitive labor market. Obviously, we border another state. That has paid child welfare workers historically significantly more than we've had the ability to pay here in our children's division, as well as a number of contractors and contracted service agencies that do often pay more and, you know, have a little bit more flexibility, you know, to be aggressive on the compensation front if it comes to incentives or things that we have to go ask for in an annual budget.
And when I did my reporting, there were 6,124 cases of alleged abuse or neglect that were still open after 45 days in St. Louis and St. Louis County. Do you have any concerns that even if your bill passes, the reports may not receive the proper follow-through unless there's clear evidence that a child is in imminent danger, which often prompts DSS and the Children's Division to spring into action?
Well, I think some of this backlog, I think having continual training for folks that might be reporting to the hotline is very important, because we want to make sure that things that make it to that level are things that do rise to the occasion of needing to be investigated. But, you know, things that happen in state government do not happen in a vacuum. I want to make sure we're doing everything we can to keep children safe. And if that means that we have to look at paying folks that are doing the investigations more in an area where it costs more to live, I think we need to have that discussion.
Yeah, and the starting salary for investigators is $43,000 a year, well, which has gone up. Like, I was talking with Representative Carrie Engel when she was an investigator, 10 years ago, she was making in the 20s. I guess there's two questions there. Why are investigators paid so little? And do you think there's going to be momentum next year to actually pay them enough so that you don't have these backlog problems?
Well, at all levels of leadership in the state of Missouri, folks claim to care about children. So I think that the voters need to hold elected officials and hold politicians' feet to the fire and make sure we're putting the money where our priorities should be. I do not think that we should look the other way if we suspect child abuse, just because we're worried about overwhelming the system. That is, you know, there are children out there counting on adults to do the right thing and to make reports. That might be the thing that keeps them alive.
To change subjects, you serve on the Senate committee dealing with agriculture issues, and a big topic is the quote-unquote banning the foreign ownership of farmland. First of all, is it really accurate to say that it's a ban if it doesn't involve confiscating land already owned by foreign corporations?
Well, that's a really good point. And, you know, there are already a lot of foreign corporations that own agriculture land in the state of Missouri. So, you know, I can't see ever being able to pass a bill that would confiscate land. So the talk moving forward is that we would freeze, that there would be no more purchases allowed. And again, this isn't foreign people, foreign-born people. This is foreign corporations and foreign governments.
How do you implement a freeze or a ban or whatever it's called without doing a significant economic harm in rural parts of the state?
Well, that's a really good question, and some of my colleagues who didn't support the bill brought that point up. They feel like when it comes time for them to sell their farmland that, you know, the free market should prevail and they should be able to sell to the highest bidder, even if that's a foreign corporation. That's their right as property owners. That's a property rights deal. You know, I think that this has been an issue that's been going on, though, for many years. Decades ago, we kind of set ourselves up for this as a state and a country, quite honestly, where we allowed corporations to take over small family farms. So this has been brewing. We maybe are talking about it more now, but it's been brewing for decades.
And
so,
I
I just think we need to have some kind of way to protect rural Missourians and folks that live in rural parts of the country so that, you know, you can still afford to be a family farmer. You know, when we see the hollowing out of small towns and rural areas, some of that is because corporations have come in and bought up all the family farms, and this is what it led to.
As to why we're talking about it now, I think it would be kind of disingenuous to say, like, a lot of people saw those ads from Trudy Bush Valentine against Schmidt on, like, the phone on his vote on that. And it's something that both Republicans and Democrats have used to attack each other throughout the years. But is there any evidence that this is actually an issue that people care about?
Well, you know, I'm not a political consultant, but I figure somebody must be polling this because obviously they talk about it every election year. But also, this was used in a Republican primary years ago for attorney general. I do remember that. So this also has led to some Republican on Republican violence as well. You know, I think the reason a lot of Democrats care about this is because of food security. So, and we saw that during the pandemic. You know, remember we had trouble getting certain kinds of protein, for example. I think, you know, this isn't about prohibiting a foreign company from owning something that makes party supplies. This is about our food security, the things that keep us alive.
When I was talking with a couple of farmers last year for a story about how Northeast Missouri has become more Republican, I asked them pretty directly, do you think that Trudy Bush Valentine's attack on Schmidt is resonating? And a couple of them said no, and for an interesting reason, because farmers who are not owned by corporations, their livelihood is not threatened if Smithfield, we're talking about Smithfield here.
Yes.
Smithfield is a company that's owned by a Hong Kong-based company. It's the reason the foreign ownership ban was removed in the 2010s. Their argument is if Smithfield exists, it doesn't really threaten the existence of other places. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think the argument is bigger than just an individual farmer in Missouri. So we have basically monopoly ownership of some very important food supply. So Smithfield Foods controls 25% of the U.S. pork industry. So that's concerning. And then Smithfield Foods here in Missouri owns over 42,000 acres of Missouri farmland. So in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot of land, but I can understand why Missourians are concerned about this.
What are some other agriculture issues that you expect to be kind of on the mind of senators and lawmakers next year?
That's a really good question. You know, with it being an election year, I'm already noticing people showing up to things in cowboy boots and cowboy hats and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think that we'll have to have a talk about tax credits. Interestingly, a lot of rural economic development issues are considered agriculture issues as well, even though a lot of the tax credit programs are not necessarily focused on, you know, traditional agriculture products. So, you know, I love serving on the agriculture committee because in St. Louis County, a lot of jobs are supported and help support the agriculture industry.
I have one more question. It's my favorite topic and Jason's least favorite topic, which is sports betting. You know, we're once again another year. What do you think is the possibility of that crossing the finish line?
Well, as somebody who watched approximately 12 hours of football last weekend, I would love to see us be able to legally bet on sports in the state of Missouri. And some of that has to do with the fact that all of the states around us have it. And I think a lot of my constituents are really frustrated that they have to drive to Illinois to place their bets and then come home to watch the game. So, you know, I'm hopeful that some of the business owners and sports teams owners might be able to get something together in time to get it on the ballot for next year. I know it would pass. For sure it would pass. Or the other option is just to wait out. You know, there seems to be one senator that's kind of holding all of this up, and that senator will be termed out at the end of next year. So maybe things will change after that.
Yeah, let's talk about initiative petitions. Are you the most prominent Missouri politician originally from Ohio?
Of course I am.
Well, I mean, why am I even asking that question? So you're well familiar that Ohio voters rejected efforts to make the Constitution more difficult to amend recently. And that comes on the heels of discussions in Missouri about different ways to raise the threshold to pass a constitutional amendment. For our listeners right now, it's a simple majority. Some people want to raise it to 57%, 60%. Some people want to, like, say it has to pass in a certain amount of congressional districts or House districts. What do you think the defeat in Ohio means for efforts in Missouri?
Well, although abortion rights were not on the ballot in Ohio when this was on the ballot, essentially abortion rights were on the ballot. And so I think voters in Ohio were wise to realize that politicians were trying to trick them into taking away their ability to pass laws and to put things into the state constitution by initiative. So, you know, Ohio voters were aware that this was a political trick. And, you know, for a century now in Missouri, majority has ruled. And the initiative petition reforms that we have discussed here in the state of Missouri would quite simply take away majority rule. And I don't think the voters are going to be okay with that.
The main argument you hear from proponents of raising the constitutional threshold is they argue that well-financed groups have hijacked the process to do ends around the legislature. Now, I understand the philosophical arguments of keeping it in place, but isn't that argument undeniably true, that well-financed groups have used that process to get what they want, like recreational marijuana being a perfect example of that?
Well, the reason this is happening and we're having this debate is because elected officials, politicians, have refused to listen to what their constituents want year after year after year. People have gotten frustrated and they decide to take it upon themselves. So we elected officials brought this on ourselves because we refused to, you know, voters wanted us to increase the minimum wage. Elected officials wouldn't do it, so they went to the initiative petition process to do that.
So you mentioned this, but this comes as there are several groups that are trying to circulate initiative petitions to legalize abortion in Missouri. But there's clearly not agreement over whether the initiative should allow for a fairly expansive right to an abortion or whether it should be more incremental. What approach do you think should be taken, and which approach do you think will be most attractive to Missouri voters?
Well, I was pleased to see that we're making some progress on getting things to the voters for signature. You know, there like hundreds of thousands of signatures need to be collected by May in order to even get on the ballot. Right now, I'm happy that there are, more than 20 different versions of making abortion safe and legal in Missouri. I'm glad that we have a bunch of options because, you know, Missouri is a moderate state and we have to figure out what is going to get across the finish line with the voters. So, you know, I know that voters are very frustrated that Missouri outlawed abortion and we're going to have to figure out a way to work our way back.
Yeah, speaking of collecting signatures, you know, a lot of these, I mean, there's at least one set that's gone through just variable legal obstacle after obstacle, whether it's through the fiscal note, now with the wording. You know, what are your thoughts? Do you think that these are intentional delay tactics? What are your thoughts that it's taking this long for people to be able to start collecting signatures on these?
Unbelievable. This is shameful, and it was all about delaying this and delaying it. And, you know, I think we're still going to get pro-choice people will get this to the ballot, but it's just going to be a lot more work.
I want to follow up on the point you made about Missourians being moderate, because the initiatives I talked about are very different. There's a huge difference between the initiatives that would create exceptions for rape, incest, health of the mother, and may go to 12 weeks of pregnancy, and another initiative which would go anywhere from 24 weeks to having no viability line at all. I'm interested to hear which you think would be more attractive to voters, because there are tangible differences between those approaches.
Very, very different. You know, a lot of women don't even know they're pregnant at 12 weeks. So it's going to be somewhere in the middle is what I have to guess. I wish I had a crystal ball and could answer that, but I don't. We just have to talk to regular Missourians and see what they want to be legal in their state.
And it's interesting because even the more modest approaches. They're being attacked the same way as the more expansive ones. Republicans are going to argue, no matter what is on the ballot, that this initiative is going to allow abortion, quote unquote, up until the moment of birth. And that could be, that message could be amplified by a very expensive opposition campaign. So what is going to be the counter activity to that message, which may resonate with some voters, regardless of what the actual initiative says?
Well, you know, voters are going to have to take the time to educate themselves and sort through all of this. It is going to be filled with misinformation, I can guarantee it, because we see that happening in other states. But, you know, Missourians, we're now living in a state where abortion is illegal. And so women have to travel to other states in order to have reproductive health care. And Missourians do not want that.
Moving on to the election, you are not on the ballot next year, but there is a high-profile Senate and governor's race. First of all, do you think it's a good thing that there is a contested Democratic primary to take on Josh Hawley?
Well, primaries are challenging because, you know, we end up wasting a lot of money fighting with our friends that, you know, we're in the same political party with. But it's part of democracy, so I'm, you know, the more the merrier.
You've been in primaries before. You actually ran as an independent once, so you've been on both sides.
I've been on lots of sides.
But continue, yes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think that, you know, in an ideal world, we want every voter to have choices, whether that's in the primary or when they go to vote in a general election. And this, you know, having choices in a Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, that's okay. It gives the voters, let the voters' voices be heard.
Do you think that the fact that the two candidates, or do you think that the fact that two candidates got into the race after Lucas Kuntz suggests that there's unease with him getting the nomination?
I have not heard that at all. And, you know, one of my colleagues got into the race as
Senator
well.
Senator Carla May, by the way.
Exactly. You know, I'm happy that a woman is running for the U.S. Senate. I think, you know, that Senator May running for the U.S. Senate gives the voters a good option. So I don't think it's dissatisfaction with Mr. Kuntz as much as they just want to give voters another choice.
And you haven't endorsed anybody in that
race.
I
have not.
How do you think House Minority Leader Crystal Quaid will fare in the governor's race? Can she piece together the necessary coalition in order to win?
Representative Quaid can do that. She's already doing that. She's covering all parts of the state right now, big towns, small towns, you name it. You know, we have had over 20 years now of Republican leadership in the state of Missouri, and Missouri voters are starting to see the results of that. So I think Representative Quaid is the right person to be our next governor, and she'd be our first female governor. She has done an amazing job leading the Missouri House of Representatives during tumultuous times, and I think she'll take those leadership skills and be very successful as a governor.
So 2 years ago, the Missouri House did something, I think, a little unexpected in that House Democrats managed to take not only, you know, three seats. They were able to flip three seats in a year that was not supposed to be favorable for Democrats.
Right.
How do you think the party is going to do in state legislative races this coming election season?
Well, under Representative Quaid's leadership, they are going to be picking up a couple more House seats next cycle. And also in the state Senate, we have three seats that are in tough districts that we need to hold on to, but we are also going to be able to flip two seats. So it'll be interesting. I think doing a show like this down the road is going to be more and more interesting because the state Senate now is basically tripartisan. You know, you've got the Democrats, you've got the extremist conservatives, and then you just have the regular conservatives. So it's basically a three-party system.
So obviously one of the seats is the Boone County seat.
Right.
Which I think even Republicans are acknowledging is going to be a very, very difficult to hold on to.
Yeah, that's District 19. Stephen Weber is running for that seat.
What's the other seat that you're targeting?
Joe Peerless out in Senate District 15. Senator Koenig terms out at the end of next year, and a friend of mine, Joe Peerless, is running for that Senate district. The interesting thing about Senate District 15 out in that West St. Louis County area is it's the district with the highest percentage of voters with college degrees, and that's exactly the type of seat that has been flipping blue across the country ever since the Dobbs decision.
Yeah, and I covered the 15th district race with Deb Lavender and Andrew Koenig, and Koenig managed to win by a lot more than I thought he would, and I think that the dynamic you saw was there were a lot of voters there that voted for Joe Biden, but they also voted for Andrew Koenig and Ann Wagner, too. So Do you think that that dynamic may shift to just them voting all Democratic? Or do you think if that, because if that dynamic repeats itself, the Republicans going to win that race, most likely.
Well, last year, Trudy Bush Valentine did really, really well in that Senate District 15 footprint. So, you know, the thing about voters out in the suburbs is they split their ballots like that. So I think the challenge with Representative Lavender when she was running against Koenig for that seat is it was during the pandemic. And Representative Lavender's strength in the past and even now as a state rep has always been her activity going door to door. And quite frankly, you know, not enough of that happened.
Well, thank you, Senator, for coming on the show. We'll have to have you back for the next 3 to 7 years. That's part of the prize of winning a Senate seat in the St. Louis area.
So it's my honor. Thanks for having me.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. Senator, how can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
I am at TracyMcCreary.com.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.